Politics is Dead meets Compliance to introduce us to the new regime that is increasingly controlling our lives. I'm delighted to welcome to the popular show with me, James A. Smith, Teresa Koldova, who is a research professor at the Work Research Institute at Oslo Metropolitan University. She's the author of this absolutely fantastic book, which I couldn't put down. It's called The Compliance Industrial Complex, The Operating System of a Pre-Crime Society. Yeah, well, we've both got it here in hard copy. I paid for this. Palgrave don't send out hard copies. I need this like by the bed at all times now. Your work was introduced to me very recently by your this Twitter user, Christopher Lash's Ghost. And as soon as Christopher Lash's Ghost turned me on to you, I knew I needed to introduce your work to our audience, which is broadly on the left, the post-left, various kinds of unidentified dissidents and the podcast world in general, because you're way ahead of everybody as far as I'm concerned. Teresa, maybe you could just sort of introduce yourself and your work to the audience, because you cover a quite dizzying range of topics.
Yes, and I think the book is very much covering very unexplored terrain. So the whole idea for the book actually came out as I tried to write about more specific subjects of anti-corruption and the way it is being shaped up today and so forth. But then I realized, well, I have to take a step back, because the whole kind of compliance industrial complex, which kind of governs our lives, has not really been described by anybody. Mm-hmm. So I felt, okay, I need to put out the book very quickly that kind of frames in a more essayistic form what are the kind of basic tenets of contemporary governance that we have not been really focusing on so much. Lots of the kind of political economy is stuck in state kind of driven paradigms, multilateral paradigms, but criminology as well, state driven. Anthropology is focusing more on the effects on the populations in different localities. And I felt like being a social anthropologist, having come into critical criminology or ultra-realist criminology, if you like, and stuff like that, I felt like, there's a real gap. I hate the word, but there was a real kind of lack of understanding of these kind of intermediaries that are actually, shaping the contours of governance, both at the global level, at macro level, at the micro level, in organizations, in corporations, in multinationals and so forth. And, all these kind of technocratic, bureaucratic processes that are happening, that are, setting the parameters for how we are to be governed, how we are to be measured, controlled, and so forth. And actually, the first time I encountered this subject, it was on two parallel tracks. I had this one article that I was supposed to write for a handbook on luxury business, of all things, on luxury and corruption. And there I realized, the connection between luxury and corruption has not been explored, whatever. But I also noticed that, we have so many anti-corruption measures out there, but they're actually not working. But the fact that they are not working is propelling this massive industry trying to combat corruption and so forth. So there's always this demand for more control that doesn't work. And on the other hand, I was working on another research project, which was basis for a previous book, which is in Norwegian, but it's on workplace investigations, basically. And there we encountered, the whole private investigator business and the way, it is completely undermining the Norwegian model of co-determination. You have these trade unions, you have this very kind of Nordic model self-understanding that is very proud. But in reality, you have all these managerial practices, HR, all these kind of data surveillance and so forth that is coming. And suddenly the workers were exposed to, all kinds of whistleblowing cases that were really not whistleblowing, but they were treated as such. And they were subject to, private investigations that were really, where the employer is basically the judge and the prosecutor and the police all in one. So you have no sense of justice in that system. And then we realized, where is this industry coming from? And to do that, we had to kind of dig into the whole kind of compliance space. And this is what kind of brought me to this, investigating this compliance industry. And then I just started following all sorts of webinars and conferences and doing field work in the industry, looking at anti-corruption, anti-trafficking, sanctions compliance, GDPR. You know, you have so many issues that, you know, corporations have to comply with. And the way it is then translated into new forms of governance and surveillance in the actual workplaces. So this was kind of the starting point. I don't know, it's such a massive subject. It's very difficult to, you know, grasp it because you need a kind of new language to talk about.
Well, I mean, your book goes a quite great distance to giving us something of that language. So we're going to talk about where the compliance industrial complex came from, what it does, who the people working in it are, and what effect it's already having on politics. But since you mentioned that those Norwegian workplace cases, I think that almost kind of works as a sort of metonym for the whole process, because what I see in what you described there is a kind of eclipsing of a model based on trade unions and employers being in a kind of collaboration and a contestation with each other, workers' rights, and if you're mistreated in the workplace, or if you find out that your employer is doing something wrong, you've got a kind of open and political process in appealing to trade unions. When you replace that with the kind of the rise of HR and the rise of processes that are kind of already in-house and in place and anticipating corruption, anticipating various kinds of interpersonal wrongdoing that can happen at work, it's actually a bigger change than it looks like at first. Maybe you could sort of take us into that case study a little bit.
Yeah, I can say that, you know, the evolution, the evolution of this kind of compliance industrial complex, what I describe, has very different trajectories as far as I don't know exactly, in different countries, but it kind of converges, you know, so it has certain drivers that are kind of epistemic. So you have the hegemony of managerial thought, right, coming from the US. You have this kind of HR thinking. You have also the different wars on crime, wars on organized crime, wars on drugs, and so forth. They also manifest in the workplace. You had this kind of anti-doping, you know, this screening of employees in the US is very common, you know, urine. It began with, you know, very kind of security crime concerns. And so you have this kind of managerial thought being, you know, first it was in a period kind of humanized. You wanted to create kind of well-being, kind of happy harmony. But now you have more of this kind of securitized harmony or criminalized harmony. You know, you kind of demand harmony through this kind of securitization. And it is a very different understanding, you know, and this, of course, these kind of managerial discourses, they, for instance, enter Norwegian workplaces because all the managers are trained in the business schools, right? So this is where you get indoctrinated pretty much in this thinking. And education that would pertain to the Nordic model is pretty much non-existing. I'm teaching a class, but, you know, the trade union people who go there. So you're preaching to the converted, basically. But what happens there is you know, in the fundamental understanding of conflict, industrial relations are built on an understanding and kind of institutionalization of conflict, right? So you assume that there is a conflict of interest between the employee and the employer and the managerial class. Whereas in HR thinking, there is no contradiction, right? The HR thinking assumes harmony. And the moment you're negative or critical, this is considered as, you know, a deviation, a deviance, something to be handled, something to be managed, something to be suppressed, and so forth. So you see a fundamental difference here. And of course, the way to evade the trade union track in the Norwegian system, for instance, is by claiming that this is not an issue for a trade union. This is an issue for a personal case. So you define an individual as problematic. So you have all the trends of, you know, legalism, this kind of juridification of relations, the individualization of relations, and so forth that manifests here. But structurally, where this comes from, for instance, that you can compare like two contexts that I know well, which is the Norwegian case and Czech Republic, where the compliance industry emerges under very different conditions, but ends up being pretty much the same because of the kind of global structures where you have the KPMG, all these big four companies, Deloitte, and so forth. So they end up at the same endpoint, but start very differently. So in Norway, you had, you know, the big oil industry, everybody knows, and obviously there have been a couple of very significant accidents that, you know, you had public outrage because of, you know, the accidents of the oil rigs. So you wanted more health and safety and security, and this is perfectly, of course. You want that. So in the name of health and safety and security, the petroleum inspectorate, they started, you know, making kind of visits to the offshore places, and they figured out, you know, we can't control the situation, you know, through these visits and through these kind of individual visits. We want to impose this internal control system, right? And this was a trend overall. You find it in other countries, but you impose internal control. So from the moment in the mid-70s or so, when you impose these systems, what you do is you get meta control, right? So basically, the all the kind of inspectorates, labor inspectorate, petroleum, whatever, they control that the companies have control systems. So you have to have really nice control systems, especially on paper. And you have to show that you have procedures and everything that in compliance with the law. And it also gives enormous power to the organizations to decide what are good practices, what you know, this is left on to the discretion of the organization. So this is how these kind of systems become introduced in Norway. And it emerges from health and safety. Then, of course, you have anti-money laundering, anti-corruption. You know, it, of course, pertains to different industries. You have financial industry initially, but then you have pretty much everybody. Even our university has to have an anti-bribery policy these days, right? So it starts with these critical infrastructure industries that are very important to control, finance, obviously, and oil and so forth. And then it moves elsewhere. In the Czech Republic, you have a completely different trajectory, because until the 90s, we were pretty much a communist country. Then we have a revolution, and then we have hyper fast neoliberalization, right? So what you want to do there is you want to introduce, they use the anti-corruption discourse, but it's the second point. First, you had organized crime units that came, and you kind of imported the American war on organized crime. We didn't have like the concept, like didn't exist in the Czech police didn't have it. We had to establish a unit for organized crime. And they said, well, this is not enough because we're seeing a lot of corruption in the political space. Why? Because introducing anti-corruption policies basically means introducing neoliberal policies, right? You have good governance, all these processes. This has been done in all developing countries pretty much through anti-corruption policies. So you introduce anti-corruption, and then, of course, you have public bodies, you have Transparency International, you have all these multilateral bodies really invested in that. And in the third phase, which is pretty much now, and the last 10 years, you commodify that. So suddenly you have, you know, a massive commodification of regulatory compliance, right? And this goes parallel with the kind of datafication and surveillance capitalism. So this kind of, this is what I try to describe, this intersection of surveillance capitalism and regulatory capitalism. But from that on, it kind of expands into everything, because anything, you know, the industry, which is the consulting industry, the regtechs, like regulatory technologies, you have even supervisory technologies, which are not so used maybe, but you have them. You have all kinds of data brokers, knowledge brokers, all kinds of metric designers and metric producers, right, for ESG, for investing. So you have all these different kind of knowledge intermediaries and brokers invested in this. And they are invested in creating precisely the type of regulation that gives them markets, right? So if you, for instance, even read the latest corporate social responsibility or corporate responsibility or sustainability reporting directive from the EU, you can just read it immediately. It says the investors want this regulation because obviously we want to invest in kind of sustainable markets. So, mm-hmm. You know, the data has to be produced, and the data comes from the metadata of compliance, right? So you created these compliance structures. Now they are starting to generate a lot of data that can be financialized, turned into new investment, new assets. And it immediately says, okay, this opens a new market and expands the market for third parties providing all these kind of data. So all these data brokers will thrive, consulting companies will thrive, because the regulation is impenetrable. It is, you know, you have 550 pages of different like EU taxonomy for sustainability. Now you're developing a new one, like it's just emerged, it's just so quick, you know. Now you have a new one that they try to do on social taxonomy, EU social taxonomy, where you try to, you know, quantify social impact and so on for kind of social impact investing, right? So all this is basically, you know, a result of all these kind of regulations that drive this industry, right? And now we see kind of not only the commodification, but in the past few years, kind of attempts at financializing this. And so when you notice what type of regulation this is and how you actually try to fight, you know, all these harms, you realize very quickly that it is a regulation imported from the financial sector. You know, you have the combination of HR, management, safety, health, you know, some kind of concern for workers, but then ultimately, it is basically this kind of policies that try to fight fraud, initially in the financial sector, insider trading, anti-money laundering, you know, all those kind of compliance things which demand a lot of surveillance. You can say it is maybe legitimate, but those kind of are then copied. and you know, everything is added into the same platform. And just the last point with the digitalization, right? When the RegTech platform emerges and where the providers of this, you know, you have IBM, you have Thomson Reuters, you have big companies providing compliance platforms, right? And compliance services. They platformize all social harms and crimes, basically, you know, and put them next to each other in a platform. It's amazing. So you have, you know, anti-trafficking, forced labor, corruption, you know, sitting next to microaggressions, bad language, harassment, you know, and you want to use the same platform to combat all these harms, but it's not really, and you know, it has this kind of preventive kind of thing to it, but you never know what happens actually and how it is used, you know, it's just a kind of posture.
So the dynamic is that there'll be some scandal or there'll be some confected reckoning where suddenly every right-thinking person is very concerned about this particular issue, and then in response to that there will suddenly be an impeccably credentialized set of people who step forward and say, well, I'm the expert in this, my company is the expert in this, we can make your company, your institution, your body compliant with these new regulations that are coming in response to the scandal. But what they actually do is not resolve the problem or the scandal. And after all, it's their job to always be reacting to this constant crisis or scandal or problem. So it's completely outside their interest to actually resolve it, even if they could. And so instead, they just keep sort of swelling the bureaucracy around the issue, employing more and more forms of oversight, etc. And also they get the authority to hold more and more records on ordinary people, ordinary workers, to gather more and more data, and that in itself becomes commodified. So we have problems, and then we have this sort of swelling of quite pragmatically dubious and extraordinarily worrying in its scope forms of surveillance. But the other interesting kind of ingredient to this in your description is that it always has to be deployed in reaction to something that nobody could approve of. Corruption is the outstanding example. Who is for corruption? You've mentioned terrorism and trafficking. Hate is a good one. Bigotry, misinformation, science denialism, climate denialism, anti-Semitism, insurrection after January 6th, Russia, shall we say, all of these things that no good person can be for. And so we open the doors to these forms of regulation. None of them regard these individual bad things as political problems or as contextual problems or as problems emerging from specific material circumstances. Certainly, we don't regard these as problems deriving from the very class and the very elites that are bringing in these forms of regulation. And as you say, in the most like hilarious way, all of these various bad things that if you're a good PMC, you have to be against, are treated interchangeably as if the same models, the same programs, the same forms of data gathering could be used for all of them interchangeably.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you have the total decontextualization and also you have the total individualization of the problem, right? So when you look at corruption, you can say that like, okay, we think of Nigeria, Russia, and these places as systemically corrupt, right? Okay, and we in the West. But when it comes to our corruption, it's like the bad apple. It's this one individual, right? And the one individual is always thought of as kind of residing at somewhere in the bottom rank. There is never a systemic problem. It doesn't allow in any sense contextual or political thinking, right? This is kind of prohibited by default in these kind of technical things. And this is also why it is so incredibly difficult to challenge, you know, because one thing is, of course, this thing like, well, you can't be for it. So, but, you know, my answer to that is always, well, you have to start asking, what are you being for when you are against these things, right?
Yes, yes,
what
yes,
is
yes.
it that you're actually putting into place? Like, is it even reasonable? Is it even working? Is it even, you know, targeting these things? And you can see that all these regulations that I talk about, you know, they kind of evade the actual issues. Absolutely, spectacularly, you know, they just pass next to them, and you can wonder, what does it serve? Whom does it serve? You know, and obviously you have, you know, this kind of collusion of elite interests that are very interesting, because on one hand it serves obviously monopolization, because you know, you can't, you know, the public procurement cannot happen if you don't have all these compliance things, right? So obviously, it will go only to big actors. So only big actors are legitimate. So you're creating legitimacy for the big, big players, and you're basically putting under suspicion all small, medium businesses. You know, you can see it regularly, like in the art industry. I'm just looking at that now, and you know, now they're implementing this anti-money laundering and you know, this big scandals in art, obviously. So you have anything from the museums and repatriation, Nazi looted art. You have all kinds of you have, of course, fakes and forgeries, and there's so much fraud, you know, and the art market has been considered as this kind of unregulated market, right? But then what does it mean to regulate it? You know, I mean, a normal sensible person would think, okay, what would you think that the regulation entails? I don't know. But you would not really imagine that it would entail a kind of anti-money laundering processes, due diligence, and know your customer kind of obligations, right? So this is basically imposed now on antiquities and art dealers also in the UK, right? And they have to implement these processes, which basically means, yeah, the big auction houses, they will appear as absolutely legitimate and clean because they have huge legal teams and they have, you know, it puts under suspicion anybody who's a small actor. So you have this very monopolization dynamic there. Another use for this is, of course, generating all this data for new kind of asset classes. You know, how do you turn the illiquid art into liquid asset? It's really, you know, by actually leveraging the data from the due diligence and compliance, which you then sell on top, and which you can, you know, there's all kinds of efforts to make this kind of investment into art. It's not really working very well, but you know, but you can see the steps to financialization, ever deeper financialization, and turning art into investment, as you know, through this kind of compliance regulation. So that's an interesting point. But, you know, none of this, of course, addresses in any sense the question of, you know, is the art looted, you know, because the reason why you implement this is you think, for instance, it's big scandals, right? The terrorists were using looted art to fund terrorist activities. So they would be, you know, digging something in Syria and then selling it on the market for the rich Western people. Okay, so you do your due diligence. Then what happens? You decide, well, I'm not going to be selling maybe this piece because it's of unsure origin. And then you basically assume somebody else will. So the only thing, you throw it somewhere else in the market. The dirt is still there, you know. But it allows you to appear as legitimate actor. I don't know where it goes. The same question, you know, you can have around all these kind of systems that try to sort, you know, like these insider threat systems. I think that, you know, this is something really we have to talk about, especially since you mentioned Russia and you know, the new kind of geopolitical situation, it's really interesting because now you have, you know, I write already about that, but you have corruption has been securitized even before the war in Ukraine. You kind of position corruption on a totally new level as a national security threat for the, from the US strategy point of view. And so basically the Biden administration says kleptocracy and so forth is undermining the rule of law and our democracy and so forth, and represents an existential threat to our nation and our national security. This is new because corruption didn't have that kind of level of importance, because securitization allows you to do a whole new range of things against, you know, in the name of security and in the name of national security. And now we see also the same concerns around, you know, China. And what is interesting is in that respect, we see kind of calls for protecting national critical infrastructure, right? And national critical infrastructure is privatized. It is no longer the Cold War like we had, you know, that we could make the kind of separation. We have globalized, we have supply chains, you know, we have multinational corporations. And there you see that all these strategies, cybersecurity strategy of the US, for instance, even the similar strategies in Norway, they call for, among other things, they call for enlisting the private sector in national security. But what does it mean, right? In a kind of globalized, intertwined world, you can, yes, you can divest from some investments in China or whatever, but you basically want to impose compliance obligations onto critical infrastructure, which is banking, universities, research institutes. We're already having it here in oil and energy industry, right? Finance. And you want them to have insider threat programs. Which is a really interesting thing, because you imagine within this logic the threat coming from individuals within the organization in the West, because now the enemy can be within, right? It is no longer the Cold War. So the enemy is within and it can undermine the system. But of course, the leadership is always clean. You direct these systems downwards. And so you try to kind of establish systems that will predict and preempt risk, you know, background checks or kind of ongoing monitoring of workers, risk flagging, psychometrics you use, sentiment analysis and so forth. And this is all legitimized with reference to people like Snowden, Manning, you know, they wouldn't have happened if we would have a proper insider threat program, because they are seen as insider threats, right? So this is how you see it in the national security point of view. But you have, you know, a really uncanny problem in this sense, right? Because the state tries to basically leverage the corporate managerial practices and you know, their ability to control the workers and the supply chains for its own interests, right? But how do you convince the corporations to actually act in national security interest? I mean, they are based in China, they might be based as much in Ireland or in the US, right? So where does their national allegiance belong? Does it belong to Norway, to the Norwegian security, or to the US security? It's a fascinating thing. But you also kind of, you know, since this kind of logic dismisses completely any kind of structural concerns, any kind of politics, it's only, you know, technocratic. You want to screen and monitor and find, you know, psychologically, you know, find you know, risk flags for individuals. You know, this comes from, you know, the spies, you have corporate espionage, all the forms. But here you see the kind of logic, and this is really a logic of kind of risk management as well. So you have the kind of national security logic, which, you know, the insider threat programs originally again start with a kind of compliance imposition, like Obama in 2011 had an executive order which basically said that all defense contractors that are supplying for the government have to have insider threat programs. This was the first time you had like a program. It's not only like, you know, managing insider threat or something, but complete programs. And then these programs that are developed for a very specific purpose of national security defense and this industry are spread into, you know, banking. And you have Goldman Sachs having these insider threat programs for its own employees, right? And so forth. So you see how this kind of immediately, if you have a management program, it will be picked up by the actors in the compliance industry. And now you have Deloitte, KPMG, you know, all of them are, you know, offering insider threat programs. And you wonder, you know, what does it do to us? Basically, you know, we are always, as employees, as suppliers, as clients, as customers, we will be perceived as potential national security threats, or but, you know, not only criminals anymore, you know.
Yeah.
At the time of writing, I was more like, okay, we're seen more or less as criminals, like you're interested in these benefits and so forth, right? These kind of benefit sanctions. This is the same logic. You're perceived as a criminal first, and then you have to prove your innocence. So the whole reversal of justice is there, right? This is why you feel this injustice in these kind of systems, right?
Is it fair to say that through the COVID years and the Russia-Ukraine war period, we've lived through an extraordinary kind of experimental renaissance in these kinds of governance products, as you call them? There's been a massive escalation of this. I mean, it's basically through the 21st century, we've seen this pattern, as you're describing there, initially deployed against aliens of one kind or another, aliens within or without. In Britain, we've got the Prevent Anti-Terrorism Program that you mentioned in the book, also the Hostile Environment Anti-Illegal Immigration Program. And those were not just employed by the police and the security services. Those were rolled out by kind of upper white collar professionals. It was almost as if your GPs and your university lecturers could keep some of their old bourgeois privileges on the condition that they agreed to become an arm of the security state. So the doctor will check the immigration status of the patient who's come in sick. The university lecturer, the teacher will be keeping an eye on Muslim students, will be instructed to keep an eye on Muslim students, and if they're acting a bit strangely, report them to the Prevent program. So there was this almost sort of ad hoc way in which, as those professions were becoming more and more kind of taken over by administration and by HR logic, there was a way in which power sort of saw some potential there, and those programs used professionals like that in order to kind of start constructing this surveillance compliance industry. We've moved forward very, very quickly. I mean, you mentioned Obama sort of initiating some of this stuff in corporate life. Well, now we've got Biden introducing the idea that corporate corruption is a national security issue, very similar directives from the EU and versions of it in the UK as well. Is it fair to say that the last few years have been a kind of massive leap in the sort of hegemonic status of this kind of approach to governance?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, all these kind of, you know, if you read kind of historical managerial literature, you find all these ideas, you know, incubating here and there. But really this kind of, this COVID, this pandemic, right, the fact that all the lots of workers were forced home, obviously, this led to the need to, you know, we have to manage your keystrokes and so forth, and take screenshots of your activity on your computer, and you will be punished if you're not working and if you have a toilet break and so forth. So all these kind of softwares became legitimate, right? Because you wanted to keep up the productivity, efficiency, so forth, and want to be safe. So a lot of this was legitimized by safety, right? So also, like, also in factories, you would have IBM had a kind of COVID surveillance thing within physical spaces where you would measure, you know, through surveillance cameras with AI, the distance between workers, you know, if it is, you know, for their safety, obviously. But, you know, these systems don't go anywhere. They just get repurposed and you want to keep on using them, obviously. So this is a huge problem. And it's this kind of naturalization of the technology as well through COVID, like, you know, you have your digital passport, like in order to be free, you have to have a passport. What kind of, you know, on your health? I mean, to me, yeah, it sounded, you know, absurd. But so obviously this normalized all that, and these kind of, that was a huge boost for the industry. And then, of course, the war in Ukraine, absolutely huge boost. I mean, if you are allowed to say something in this respect, but obviously the anti-corruption industry gained a huge boost because of the securitization of this cause as well. And you had and of course the sanctions regime is a huge, massive compliance nightmare. So this is the sanctions are just increasing and increasing in number. This is the kind of paradoxical drive of this. You're often arguing with like targeted smart sanctions, and everything is targeted. It's like surgical strikes. There's no harm. Look away. We're just taking out the idea of taking out the kind of diseased or a part of the political body and or the terrorist and so on is still there, right? So you want to surgically target these oligarchs on top at the same time as you have export sanctions and all the other economic sanctions, obviously. But this drive towards, it's kind of a euphemization of kind of a totalitarian drive, right? So you have, because the targets just proliferate. Like, and once you set this logic, you just see it appearing everywhere. And it's just, you can, like with this, you mentioned this Labour party, this anti-Semitism, cause. You see the same dynamics playing out, the same kind of remedies being proposed and so forth, right? So I didn't even follow on that in this sense. And then I just looked at it and I was like, yes, this follows the same logic. You just put, sexual harassment, anti-Semitism and so forth. So the targets proliferate. And the fantasy is really one of total control, of absolute total control of everything. And there's always a gap, right? So if you look at the rhetoric we have another book coming around on luxury and corruption, challenging the anti-corruption consensus with Bristol University Press. And there we write a lot about, the fantasy of the gap. There's always, the problem is not the system. The problem is always some kind of hole in the law. All this whole London is kind of London grad, all this money laundering evasion is happening there, but it's just a little hole. We just need to kind of fill it, right? So the answer to the problem will never be systemic. And I think that the more this kind of system proliferates, the more we will have trouble challenging it in any meaningful way. I think that this is the problem, and the sanctions. Of course, you have a whole new industry. Like, of course, you have how I conceptualize it is the proliferation of kind of privatized and pluralized policing and intelligence. And with sanctions, this is even more like fascinating, right? Because sanctions compliance is on us, on the members of the states, on individual citizens and companies. We have to comply with the sanctions. It's like not the Russians, right? So the imposition is on us. People often misunderstand, I think, this is the basic point. And so it is up to me to do my due diligence, to not, fund in any way, sell things to a Russian and so forth. And for that, you have to have these compliance systems. And this requires enormous amount of data. Of course, we don't have databases for most of it, so it's very easy for the very rich to evade sanctions. This is not such a difficult task, actually. You have all these like problems. You have sanctions against, Chinese forced labor. You have all these Russians. They have Russian names and Chinese names. And, you transliterate. You have so many like data problems in compliance that it just becomes this massive, almost like super overwhelming task if you really want to comply with the law, that is. So it is no wonder that you have all these providers and that you have these businesses entering this space and, saying, here is our fast, effective, efficient solution. Just buy a subscription. We will do all the screening for you. It is an impossibility, with all these, corporate reporting that is now coming from the EU, which is really every single company above 500 employees, even some of them over 250. So it's not so big companies, really. And they have to produce, generate these reports. So obviously you will have that, but the problem is that this is kind of positioned as the solution to our problem, there is effectively very little enforcement. Like, you fine banks for compliance violations, basically for not having a really nice compliance system. You don't really fine them for actually money laundering. You know, this is never kind of admitted. So you know, with the internal control system, you really just, you focus on, you know, even they would fine you for not having sufficient sanctions compliance. And so forth.
So the transgression is never what you've actually done. It's that you didn't have the right system in place. And as you alluded earlier, that is sort of prejudicial against smaller businesses and smaller companies that can't sort of pay for the deluxe, you know, package that makes it look like you're fully compliant. It's a golden age of snake oil. In the first instance here, I mean, you think of how COVID, okay, we need these new platforms, we need these new, you know, updated policies. Every professional class job became this kind of rewriting of all policies in order to preemptively avoid being sued. A hell of a lot of that went on in universities over how the degrees were going to be awarded. First of all, somebody, you know, comes along and says, oh, I can provide your what you need so that you'll be compliant. And then the investigation into the corruption of buying those products is the next kind of stage of it, where, oh, now we have to have an investigation and new regulations because the stuff we bought last time around was fake and they were corrupt too. So, corruption is, as you say, a deeply apolitical concept. I mean, we need only remember that in Brazil, it was a massive kind of moral panic against corruption that got Lula imprisoned. From the point of view of the left, it'll always be left-wing leaders who are the first kind of people to fall when we use these moralizing, apolitical, vague, nebulous terms of judgment, because you use it against anyone.
You can use it in any way. You know, the right uses it, the left uses it. That's what you have, a completely kind of populist. It's a populist notion that is empty. Can be, it's kind of empty, floating signifier. You can just attach it to about any kind of politics, and you can mobilize kind of affect and emotions on the side of the public, right? And there is legitimate outrage, but it is not channeled to any kind of solution. So you have, and this is the fascinating thing, you know, how you have all these kind of techno-bureaucratic, highly, you know, technical expert committee processes and regulations on one hand, but they are kind of underpinned by, you know, very primitive kind of moral narratives about, you know, the good and the bad, basically. It's pretty much as simple as that. And so we have this high level of moralizing discourse and techno-bureaucratic discourse, but you don't have any politics. That's not allowed.
What about the preemptive dimension of this? Your subtitle is The Operating System of a Pre-Crime Society. And this is another of the kind of very novel elements of this. It's not so much about people doing something wrong, being accused, found out, tried, and then punished. It's the other way around. It's the aspiration to anticipate and prevent the possibility of committing a crime, or indeed the aspiration to criminalize in advance the people who are going to commit the crimes anyway. Could you talk a bit about that dynamic?
Yeah, I mean, it aligns with this kind of risk thinking, detecting risk and so forth, but it actually comes from ideas, or it converges again with these kind of policing notions. You have this idea of predictive policing, you have intelligence-driven policing, you have data-driven policing, all these kind of notions are embedded into this. And you have kind of the notion of situational prevention that has become really popular also in policing. So you basically think that you can, you know, you can spot signs, you know, it's just, again, a bit of this kind of zero tolerance is mixed into it. So, you know, you have all these ideas converging, and you have also these notions of, you know, being able to, yeah, for flag risks and so forth. So all these kind of things merge, you know, so you have very, you have different, but in the space, you know, see, it's like this kind of expert-driven policy, right, is also a part of this imaginary. So you think that, you know, experts can predict certain things, can see things coming. It's an aspirational thing. It doesn't really work, right? It's a lot of snake oil. It's massive snake oil. Like in the AI space, everybody who tells you can predict things, you can't, more or less. And also, you know, the models are flawed, the theories are flawed. It's just, you know, you don't even know where to begin. But it sells, definitely. And it is this kind of, this is the notion that is also built into these regulations. You know, when you have like the AI Act and things like that coming, you will have a risk-based regulation, right? Risk-based regulation aims to, by default, almost prevent and predict calculate the probability, right? So you have probability calculations of certain things happening, certain people becoming a problem. But all these kind of notions are really left to the discretion of the companies and the providers, you know. So lots of these regulations might be well intentioned, some maybe not so much, some maybe very much whatever, feeding certain interests, but the power of translating them into practice is really left to these intermediaries, and this is kind of part of what is so disturbing. And there you see that it is not so surprising that this kind of predictive, preemptive logic, which has become very popular in policing, is translated here, because lots of the people working in the kind of financial fraud space, in the compliance space, a lot of them come from police, from intelligence services. It's full of former intelligence, former police, also regulatory agencies, people, and so forth. But you have a lot of them. So you basically, what a retired policeman does is start a compliance company. or join one of these. And so you have, you know, these groups like financial crime investigators, or even like anti-trafficking, open source intelligence investigators. They all use investigative techniques that they have learned in the police and so forth. And they try to, you know, merge them with this kind of managerial thought. So now you have these kind of professional task forces, basically both in the private and the public sector, but who they consist of and what kind of epistemic thing is that? It's really HR and the corporate kind of psychology, psychometrics is very, very influential. Then you have, of course, all these managerial thoughts, and then you have policing, then you have IT. And you see how when these teams work together, how the logics from IT very smoothly merge, and like cybersecurity very smoothly merge with kind of the HR and individualization logic, and of course lawyers, legal auditors, of course. Because this kind of, you know, you have notions like that I always find a bit funny in the cyberspace, cybersecurity, you have zero trust environments, right? But when you say things like that, it means, you know, of course you want to secure your computer network. That's pretty much it. And you don't want, you know, it might have legitimate reasons to do that, obviously. But in the kind of, when you work together with HR, it gets translated almost naturally into zero tolerance policies, right? So it's very smooth. And then you have the other notion from cyberspace, which is the single source of truth, right? So all these, you will notice it, because that means basically that you have one data set that can address all these different issues. So you know, and what kind of thing does it tell you? Well, there's only consensus. There's only one single source of truth about our company, about our workers. You know, this is the one place we go to get all the data we absolutely need to tackle all the problems we have. So you see that in the providers of these services, they will market it like, you know, we give you the single source of truth for compliance, for anti-corruption, sanctions, GDPR, you just name it, you know, and it will just get added on top of it. So these notions, you know, become translated. And then you imagine, what does it mean that, you know, the company has a single source of truth on me? Do they? You know, it just becomes very absurd.
But So for all we've heard about abolishing the police in the last few years, actually, these are all ways in which what historically would have been thought of as the duty of the police has actually been transferred to corporate actors.
Corporate actors, also like you're saying, schools, universities, everybody. Because through this compliance logic, it is your legal and moral obligation. And like you noticed, you said this thing, I forgot to respond to that, but that the teacher, you know, gets a certain power, of course, and you know, you have no qualifications to profile people for their potentiality for future terrorism. You know, it's absurd. No. But you must also consider that the worker, I mean, there's a colleague, she did interviews with people, you know, working under this Prevent Act, and she was saying, well, the teachers, they have to do it because otherwise they risk being punished, right, for their non-compliance. So even if it goes against your moral understanding or ethical or political sentiments, you must do it because then you are threatened, right? So this, it is, you just end up in this kind of spiral of bureaucratic, it's like a big Kafka thing, you know, and it's just
once you sort of turn on those lenses, you do just see it absolutely everywhere, from the most serious areas to more banal ones. I mean, YouTube's model of, you know, it's no longer a police matter if you've done hate speech or spread dangerous misinformation and so on. It's YouTube, but it's not people at YouTube. It's an algorithm that hears that you used a certain phrase, even if you used it in scare quotes in order to give a good, dutiful, liberal criticism of something naughty, your account is taken away. And it's, you know, maybe you can appeal, but it's always retrospective because the pre-crime logic has come into play. You mentioned something I'd said before to you about the Labour anti-Semitism case. I mean, the element of that just nobody has spoken about is that the UK's Equalities Commission, in its report into the Labour Party, has set the precedent that it is your political party's job to check your social media likes and judge what, you know, whether you think dangerous or bad things on the basis of it. So again, it's not like, oh, you've said something or done something or done a hate crime and the police come around. It's that the political party that you willingly joined because you wanted to participate in public life now has the duty to examine you. And just like the teacher who doesn't morally want to report their students, the political party is now culpable if it doesn't check your social media likes. So it's as you describe it, it's just in area after area. I mean, debanking is another one that we saw. I feel like the elites are sort of experimenting with how far they can go with these things. And these companies are sort of trying to one-up each other on how compliant they can appear to be. So, you know, protesters against vaccine mandates, the truckers in Canada. Okay, you participate, first of all, because you weren't vaccinated, you can't go, you know, participate in public life, participate in social life. But now because you went to a protest about it, the bank gets to show how compliant it is by removing your bank accounts. You know, we flash forward a year and they're doing it to arbitrarily chosen Russian business people because, oh, well, you must be an oligarch. You must be part of money laundering. So, I mean, the funny thing is that some of these targets are on the left. Some of these targets are on the right. And it's very difficult to get a political constituency together to say, hang on, this is all the same stuff and this is all the same exercise of power. And if you're against one of them, you should be against the other. I mean, I wonder where you see the sort of the politics of this, because it's, you know, the right has always complained about the administrative state and regulation. It's been less willing to acknowledge, as you point out here, that often corporate actors want to be regulated and actually want it more than states want to do it. On the left, meanwhile, you know, in 2009, we had Mark Fisher saying that neoliberalism is characterized by market Stalinism and the left has to oppose bureaucracy and audits, etc. Well, now you never hear that on the left, because if it wasn't for HR and the auditors, how would we decolonize the workplace? How would we, you know, preserve the legacy of Me Too? Actually, now the left supports a lot of the things that you're criticizing. So it's quite hard to see, despite the fact that anyone would read the book and hate the things that you're describing and recognize them in their own lives. But it's quite difficult to imagine what the political protest or reaction against them could be.
Yes, I honestly don't know. I mean, what I find, you know, is this kind of consensus, all this is kind of consensus-driven regulations, right? Obviously, everybody agrees at some level. Everything is legitimized by this kind of multi-stakeholder logic. The stakeholders have been involved and so forth. So you can't really, you know, and of course, this kind of technical nature of this, and all of this is also coming from the transnational bodies, right? EU and so forth. So the nation states are basically told, go implement. You know, and you can make your little small amendments or whatever. So you really wonder what is the political capacity to actually challenge this, even, you know, even if you would have a political party that would kind of say like, hey, let's look at more closely at what we're actually being for. Yeah. Very difficult. At the workplace level, you know, I have another article about this from the university and from my also own experience as a trade union person. You get, you know, we have this co-determination practices, you're involved, you participate, you're informed, you get all these kind of consultancy reports presented, you know, there's always a process, there's always an audit, there's always, you know, you don't know what is important. So, you know, all these kind of transparency initiatives that also the left really likes, you know, we need accountability, we need transparency, we need more data. You have to really wonder, okay, who's giving me the data? How am I supposed to even know what is important? So you get so overwhelmed. And this is also in all interviews with like trade union representatives, you have the same thing. People get so overwhelmed by this amount of data and the sheer, you know, the language of these reports these consulting companies come up with. It's just so difficult to challenge. And so when you sit in a meeting and you raise a fundamental principled question, you're laughed at, you know, it's just a joke, because there is no way to speak about political issues or principled or fundamental issues in another language. And I think this is the key problem. You know, the language is like colonized. The language of governance has been colonized by this discourse. And there's just, I don't see how to break with it, you know, and it always reminds me of this article, there's this sex and death among the defense intellectuals or something like that by Carol Cohen, where she, you know, is doing field work as a woman among like the nuclear strategists, you know, and they come up with this techno-strategic language around, you know, the nuclear warfare basically, and you know, there is no way to bring in any humanity or politics, you know, this is a technical strategic question, and I feel like that, you know, you feel totally kind of disempowered vis-a-vis this kind of rhetoric, because, you know, again, how do you argue against best practice? How do you argue against the auditing, you know? Isn't it good to have accountability? Isn't it, you know, it all sounds wonderful, right? But then you see the layering of that. It's just, you know, that what I, you know, see also in the trade unions try to do so, okay? So we do some research and then they try to, you know, use that research to have a different research argument, right? Say, but then it just becomes this battle of experts on co-opted by one side or the other, where obviously the side of the employer is always more powerful, so you're bound to just, you know, lose in some sense. So, you know, to me, like the solution cannot be within the kind of master's own terms. You know, the solution cannot be another audit. You see, this is the solution, and it's driven into like levels of absurdity, right? So you discover all these kind of algorithmic harms and injustices. So you say like, okay, so now we use these regtech companies to comply. Okay, they have algorithms. These algorithms might not be, you know, perfect. So we have to do algorithmic auditing on the regtechs, right? So who's going to be doing that? Like, you just end up in this endless loop of auditing and investigations and policing and mistrust and kind of apolitical hell to me. I don't know. Where the fundamental questions are totally evaded. Like, I was now on Sunday, Saturday, we visited Prato in Italy with my colleague Audrey Miller, and she's working on the fashion and textile industry there. And you see, this is absolutely crazy. You have a Chinatown. You have basically the Chinese police has a station there to police the Chinese within Italy on its sovereign territory. So you have basically the you know, and apparently it has been led at least for a while by the local Chinese mafia. You have human trafficking. She's working with migrant workers who have been, you know, trafficked through different routes from Libya, working in forced labor conditions, you know, in the middle of EU, in Italy. And, you know, of course, working in workshops, supplying luxury brands, supplying fast fashion, supplying the made in Italy, wonderful clothes. And, you know, and you have this and you have, you know, everywhere in Prato, you have on lots of corners, you have stickers with like Chinese text and phone number. And we took pictures of that. Then we put it into a translator, found out it's for prostitution. So you have all kinds of, you know, little girl here and so on. Horrible. And so you see, you know, the sweatshops, you pass them, you hear the sewing machines, you know, you see basically forced labor in the middle of the town. You see prostitution, you see, you know, you almost can feel the connections between, you know, local police is kind of powerless. Maybe they are on it. I don't know. You have the Italian mafia involved. You have the trafficking industry involved, right? And, you know, and then, you know, I am sitting here writing about the compliance industrial complex that, you know, is telling me like by supply chain due diligence and anti-trafficking compliance and screening online you know, KYC, we're going to save the world. I mean, it just becomes so absurd.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's like that with so much of our discourse around technology as such, really. So when Margaret Thatcher came in and was talking about, you know, turning Britain into a service economy, an American diplomat was kind of confused by this and said, how can you run an economy on everybody opening doors for each other? It seems like today what we want is an economy based on everybody auditing each other and sanctioning each other. And that's the only job that's left. And even if your job is on paper something else, that's the main thing that you're expected to do. But alongside all that banality and that sort of reducing everything in the world to data and to form filling, there's also this weird utopianism to so much of what's being presented here. I mean, obviously, in the kind of solutionism that you describe, that, you know, we've got all these complex and internationally gradated problems, we can solve them with this one weird trick, with this kind of magic data, or even as you mentioned somewhere in the book, this idea of kind of tailored laws. I mean, we already have tailored policing where they're reading your data profile to see if you're going to commit crimes or whether you're going to skip out on your rent or whether you're going to be able to pay back your credit card. All these kind of things are tailored to us individually. Some of these people are saying, well, why not have laws tailored to us individually?
You know, they even provide these wonderful examples that they don't even reflect about. I think, like, for instance, if you have a camera inside your car, that's the kind of vision, you know, they give an example. You have a camera inside your car, it reads that you're a bit tired today. Maybe you drank last night. Maybe it can even, you know, measure you or something. So basically, it sets the speed limit for your car. You know, so everybody would get individualized speed limit based on the I don't know how the traffic would flow, but you know, it's just this absurdity of this total individualization.
So states can't do anything anymore. Yeah. You can't say, oh, I want this to happen, make the power of the state to make it happen. All we can do is stop things happening. We can't even do that. So all we do is kind of create a lot of job titles and a lot of expensive systems and credentialized bodies in order to kind of claim that they're stopping it happening. This is a terrible state of affairs, but I'm so grateful to have the guidebook to understanding it, which is this book, The Compliance Industrial Complex, The Operating System of a Pre-Crime Society. I hope that we can speak again and get you back on the show now that we've kind of introduced the broad kind of map of your thinking to listeners. It'd be great to pick up on some of these case studies a little more specifically.
Absolutely. Anytime.
Teresa Koldova, it's so great to have you on The Popular Show. Thanks so much for making time for us today.
Thanks for having me.